to start. So welcome to this last talk of the colloquium. And so it's with great pleasure that I want to introduce you the last keynote speaker of the colloquium, Bernard Stiegler. And so we really invited Bernard Stiegler because of his reflection on the social, political, and cognitive stakes of technological development, and especially, I would say, digital technologies. We were also interested in his reflection on the relationship or the impact of technology, the development of technology on processes of individuation and disindividuation. So Bernard Stiegler is the director of the Institute for Research and Innovation located in Paris, a professional fellow at Goldsmiths College in London, and professor at the University of Technology of Compiègne, where he teaches philosophy. And there he has a special, I believe, yearly seminar that deals with questions of science and cognitive technology. He also worked at one point on a unit there dealing with knowledge organization and technical systems. So Bernard Stiegler is also one of the founders of the philosophical and political group Ars Industrialis, which is based in Paris at Le Centre Georges Pompidou, which calls for an industrial politics of the mind by exploring the possibilities of cognitive technology in order to bring forth a new, what he called, a new life of the mind. So Bernard Stiegler has published numerous books, articles on philosophy, technology, digitization, capitalism, consumer culture, etc. So among his writings, I'll just name a few, three volumes of La Technique et le Temps, in English translation, Techniques and Time, that was in 1994, 96, and 2000. Also his two volumes, De la misère symbolique, the three volumes of Mécréance et Discrédit, that's 2004, 2006, and the two volumes of Constituer l'Europe, I believe it's around 2005, which are particularly well known. He also published Repenser l'esthétique in 2009, and État de choc, Bêtise et savoir, 2012. Bernard Stiegler will speak to us tonight about participation, contribution, and trans-individuation, yes. So please help me in welcoming Bernard Stiegler.
Merci. Thank you very much, Christine, and for your invitation. This lecture is a sort of commentary of and for the book proposed by Mediat McGill. It is also a kind of commentary about the questions pointed out by Kate Hales yesterday morning, and where I see in my commentary critique as play. And for this, I will try to address the question of the non-conscious systems described by Kate Hales by distinguishing analytic understanding and synthetic reason in a post-conscious way. The ambiguity of participatory condition described yesterday morning by Christine Ross is what I analyze as the pharmacological character of the digital technology. The disappointment faced with the reality of the participatory condition is the current experience of a new pharmacological condition created by the digital pharmacon. This is what I call a video book. And I claim that this should become the support of new academic practices for research and teaching, as MOOCs, books or SPOCs, that is small private online courses, for speaking with Robert Louis in Harvard. New academic practices based on what I call contributory categorization and transindividuation of knowledge. Before developing that, I still need to analyze and characterize briefly the history of academic knowledge in its relation to its mnemonic media. The advent of the digital amounts to a radical transformation of what Michel Foucault called in 1966 the episteme. Foucault showed after Les Mots et les Choses in 1969 that such an episteme is based on an archaeology which is the material condition of an archaeology of knowledge. If the digital can be compared to the printing press, it is because the advent of the print transformed knowledge of all kinds, constituting a new episteme and a new archaeology of knowledge. But long before either of these events, the advent of handwritten alphabetic writing made possible the birth of so-called rational knowledge. Rational knowledge is a type of knowledge for which geometry is canonical, and geometry is what alphabetical writing made possible, just as it made possible public law. Reason, or what the Greeks called logos, is itself fundamentally shaped by the experience of geometry insofar as it is the canon of demonstration, that is, of logical truth. This geometrical truth, however, could not have been conceived without the practice of writing. This is what Husserl showed in 1936 in this book. My own thesis is that writing is necessary for the formation not just of geometry, but of logos itself as conceived by the Greeks, that is, as rational. What is called reason is a form of attention. And attention is itself an arrangement operating between what Husserl referred to as retentions, that is, R in this formula, memories if you prefer, and protentions, P, that is, expectations. Via the intermediary of technical retentions, here R3, that is, mnemotechnics, which I call tertiary retentions. Alphabetical writing, like digital writing, is a type of tertiary retention. Attentional forms, which constitute ways of thinking, are arrangements of retentions and protentions, made possible by mnemotechnical forms of memorization. Thinking, in all its forms, is a temporal fabric of what Husserl called primary and secondary retentions and protentions. A temporal flux or flow, such as, for example, a speech that you might listen to, as in fact you are doing it at this very moment, can only constitute itself as such because it is an aggregation of what Husserl called primary retentions. In the course of this speech that I am delivering before you, and that you seem to be listening to, you retain in a primary way each of the elements that are presented. Primary here means that each element that presents itself in each instant aggregates itself to the element that follows it in the next instant and is retained in it, with which it forms the now of the temporal flow. hence phonemes that aggregate to form a word, words that aggregate to form a sentence, sentences that aggregate to form a paragraph, and so on, so that a unity of meaning is formed. These aggregations that accumulate one upon the other form what Husserl called primary retentions. These primary retentions are, however, selections. They are retained only on the basis of retentional criteria, criteria that are formed in the course of my prior experience. And my experience is precisely an accumulation of secondary retentions, which are former primary retentions that subsequently become past, and which constitute the staff of my memory. Each and every one of you who are currently listening to me will be hearing in what I say something different. And this is so because what I say is a flow of primary retentions from out of which each of you make a different selection. To the degree that each of you have different memories composed of different secondary retentions resulting in different criteria for retaining and understanding what I tell you. Each one of you pays attention to what I say, therefore, in a singular way. But what nonetheless unites your different ways of hearing what I say, and thus ensures the possibility of forming an agreement between all your various understandings of what I tell you, is a rational, attentional form. The latter is formed through apodictic experience, of which geometry is the canonical example, on the basis of which my speech tries to bring about an agreement between you and me. This process, which is made possible by the literal, that is, lettered, tertiary retention that emerged around 800 before Christus in the Mediterranean basin, constitutes an attentional form through which a rational transindividuation process is produced. To clarify this point, I must introduce concepts that derive from yet another philosopher, Gilbert Simondon, who showed that to individuate psychically is always to contribute to a collective individuation, and that this psychosocial individuation generates a trans-individual, that is, shared meanings, which are equally collective secondary retentions, and which always themselves presuppose supports or carriers that enable them to be transmitted through time. These supports or carriers are technical objects in general, and hypomnesic techniques in particular. Hypomnesic technologies such as, or mnemotechnologies such as writing amount to spatial projections of events that are firstly psychic, and, as such, temporal. More generally, all technical supports, objects, and practices are the result of a process of technical individuation. This is why psychic and collective individuation is always also a technical individuation. And this is a very clear situation in the participatory condition. This means that noetic psychic individuation, that is, thinking, is conditioned by technical individuation, but not determined by it. The technical artifact always opens a field of indefinite possibilities. This field of possibilities ranges from the worst to the best, because the technical artifact for example, writing, is a pharmacon, a poison that can become a remedy, or vice versa. Such a pharmacon constitutes what I call tertiary retention. Any tertiary retention, whatever it may be, is always a spatialization of temporal experience. Toolmaking, for example, is the spatial concretization of the time of the gestures through which the tool is fabricated. In the same way, alphabetical writing makes possible the spatialization à la lettre, in letters, of geometric reasoning as a series of movements of thought, which can, according to Husserl, become apodictic only on this condition, because this reasoning can thus control the temporization that is geometric thinking by spatializing it as it forms it. This control to the letter, which is a grammatization of the very time of thinking, and which results in a recording of the synaptic circuits of the literate mind, as shown by Marianne Wolf in this book, is the condition of the apodictic coherence that grounds Western reason and the base that is the reading brain. All forms of thinking found on earth are distinguished by and as such arrangements of primary, secondary, and tertiary retentions and pretensions. It follows that members of the Paleolithic society do not think in the same way as do those who belong to a shamanic society, where the shaman works with instruments, that is, tertiary retentions, for example, these soul catcher, who in turn think differently from those who belong to an ideographic society or an alphabetical society of handwritten manuscripts or the society of the printing press and so on. As for we ourselves, we live in a society dominated by digital tertiary retentions, which we produce voluntarily or otherwise as personal data, but which becomes less and less personal and more standardized because it is controllable by systems, by hidden and performative top-down systems, such as those that reticular writing establishes via those systems that control what is referred to as big data today. It was Plato who first said that writing, and more generally all hypomnesic tertiary retention, such as the digital, is a pharmacon. Plato claims to submit writing to the control of the dialectic in the Phaedrus. This presumes, however, that the dialectic does not itself need writing in order to exist, and what Jacques Derrida showed is that no such assumption is possible. By believing in the possibility of controlling writing with something that actually has writing as its condition, Plato was intoxicated by a pharmacon that, by causing him to believe in the possibility of controlling it, created the metaphysical illusion par excellence, the delusion that it would be possible to eliminate the toxicity of the pharmacon. The toxic and curative possibilities of the pharmacon are always distributed through the establishment of this or that pharmacon as dominant and characteristic of an epoch, such as the era of handwritten alphabetic writing. These possibilities put to work the two irreducible tendencies active in all transindividuation processes, through which not only psychic but collective retentions and pretensions are formed, metastabolized, transmitted, and transformed. It is ensembles of these that constitute knowledge. Transindividuation results from a composition between the tendencies towards synchronization, that is, stabilization, and the tendency towards diachronization, that is, destabilization. In the Phaedrus and in the Republic, Plato defines philosophy as a medicine for the soul, that is, as a therapeutic. But for Plato, this in no way means that philosophy is an art that deals with the pharmacological situation characteristic of mortals who emerge from the forgetting of Epimetheus and the theft of Prometheus, as told in Protagoras, one of the earliest dialogues by Plato. A decade before the Phaedrus and the Republic, in the myth of Prometheus and Epimetheus, as told in Protagoras, and as opposed to the metaphysical view that prevails in the Republic, the therapeutic was conceived as an hermeneutic, that is, as an art of interpretation that Hermes provides to mortals. This mythology constitutes the essence of tragic culture, as shown by Jean-Pierre Vernon. The tragic is represented here by the serpent, which is a symbol of the pharmacon in Greece, and which adorns the caduceus of Hermes. By the time of the Phaedrus and the Republic, Plato, on the contrary, attempts to obliterate this hermetic and hermeneutic situation, that is, a tragic situation inaugurated by the theft of fire, that is, by the ambivalence of the pharmacon. In the Republic, this repression is translated politically as a political implementation of the epistemological discourse on the essence of the dialectic that is laid out in the Phaedrus, where the dialectic is defined as that which, preceding writing, can thoroughly control and totally eliminate its toxic effects. And this amounts to replacing hermeneia by the dialectic. Founded on the repression of the role of the pharmacon, that is, writing, in the formation of the literate mind, which alone, according to Husserl, is capable of geometrizing apodictically, which is also to say of dialecticizing in the Platonic sense and of dialogizing in the Socratic sense, that is, anamnesically. The program of Plato's academy is to form what modernity calls ratio. In referring to the literate mind, Walter Ong showed in 1983, like Husserl, that the formation of philosophical reason occurs through the arrangement of retentions and pretensions made possible and metastabolized à la lettre in letters, that is, made possible and metastabolized by literal tertiary retention, which constitutes the technological milieu, firstly of Greek logos, then of modern reason, but in the latter case, via the printing press that is massively distributed and where mechanical reproduction is completely different from the interpretation that was the gloss, the commentary. It is only because this logos is a techno-logos, that is also the toxic potential of a regressive power, that the pharmacological being, that is the noetic soul that we are, must constantly decide what is, that is, what is curative, what is good, just, true, beautiful, but also what is useful and or harmful in the toxic situation itself. And all this is possible only because the pharmacon that tertiary retention constitutes itself conditions the arrangements of psychic as well as collective secondary retentions and protentions. Knowledge, properly speaking, occurs only on the condition that psychic retentions and protentions become collective and social retentions and protentions. It is in this precisely that the process of trans-individuation consists, a process that is made possible by the pharmacon. Rational, in the Greek sense, rational noetic trans-individuation constitutes academic knowledge on the basis of dialogical processes, which are co-individuation processes between two or more psychic individuals who form anamnesic circuits, that is, who reactivate the entire circuit of a chain of knowledge accumulated from axioms in the form of collective retentions and protentions. And it is such anamnesis that are played out in the Socratic dialogues. Such logical and anamnesic trans-individuation, however, presupposes publication in the form of literal tertiary retentions that are accessible to the community, of peers that the citizens of the city in principle form, and within this political community, accessible to the community of geometers, the community of philosophers, and so on. Such communities of peers, by publishing and tracing trans-individuation processes in lettered form, exposes these peer communities to critic. This public critic is judgment, in Greek, doctrinon. And it is the condition of possibility of logos as the power and knowledge of noetic expression. Modernity, where modern reason appears as rational, unfurls only when printed writing becomes reproducible and widely accessible to the community of peers that is referred to as the Republic of Letters, and that forms a new process of trans-individuation through which Western Europe undertakes a global and unprecedented territorial expansion, notably through the missions of the Society of Jesus that exported around the world the intellectual technologies emerging from the printing press in terms of grammars and dictionaries. All this, as Sylvain Auroux has shown, constitutes a new stage of the grammatization of minds. The realization of this program is then shaped by the new conditions for the formation of noetic attention that come with the creation in the West and its colonies of the schools of the Reformation, then Jesuit colleges, then especially in France, national and secular public schools, and academic systems of education and scientific research founded on the apparatus of mass publication, which appeared during the 19th century along with printed newspapers, and that enabled the printing and distribution of academic textbooks and popular publishing of all kinds up to the paperback. At the same time, however, there occur, firstly, transformations in the ways of reading, resulting from a daily publication of what becomes information or entertainment, but no longer knowledge. And secondly, a break with these ways of reading, when the analog media, which appear at the beginning of the 20th century, make possible the development of a new consumerist industrial society funded on the communication industries. Together, these transformations of and breaks with ways of reading organize a new age of the capture and formation of attention. That is, to a great extent, a deformation of attention, in that it bypasses and short-circuits the various instances of the constitution of arrangements of psychic, collective, and hypomnesic retentions and pretensions in which consist the transintegration processes inherited from political noises and founded on apodictic experience by community of peers. There is not enough time now to develop this point. It would nevertheless be necessary to analyze in detail in order to conceive how digital tertiary retention could be socialized today noetically. Under what conditions can digital pharmaca, the production and exploitation of which now constitutes the core of industry, which is thus becoming above all an industry of retentions and pretensions, under what conditions can these forms of industrial tertiary retention that are digital pharmaca, which solicit, treat, and redistribute via digital retentions, primary and secondary collective and psychic retentions and pretensions, under what conditions these forms can be socialized noetically and not regressively? In recent years, higher education teaching practices have appeared that are based on digital networks and that are referred to nowadays as MOOCs, Massive Open Online Courses. This is the one of Coursera. The first one was mine, pharmacon.fr. These raise 100 questions, including in particular that of certification and the constitution of credits for students whose courses are supposed to form psychic apparatuses according to the canon of rational attentional formation. Rational attentional formation. Do MOOCs contribute to a noetic socialization of digital tertiary retention? Or are they, on the contrary, a regression when compared to noetization by the letter? Are there pharmacological characteristics poisonous or curative? A better understanding of these questions requires an understanding of what constitutes the specificity of digital tertiary retention with regard to the formation of academic circuits of transindividuation, and such that they tend to conform to the apodictic canon of rationality. Digital technology, which, according to Clarice Ehrenschmidt, establishes the age of reticular writing, is based on the computer, which, more than anything, is an artificial organ of automated categorization. That is, that automatically produces digital tertiary retentions on the basis of other digital tertiary retentions. The automation of categorization makes it possible to delegate operations of analysis and understanding to digital systems. From very simple operations, such as scanning for occurrences of a word in a text, to far more complex ones, such as modeling quantum objects in physics, or the calculation of correlations in big data, etc. Delegating such operations to machines has the following consequence. The certification processes, in which all transindividuation processes always consist, are altered, and in some cases, dangerously short-circuited. It is not just that the analytic capacities of the understanding are delegated to machines, but that the synthetic capacities of reason, not of understanding, are utterly wiped out. However, in the case of nanophysics, the conditions of intuition are artificially reconstituted by the understanding, the quantum scale being inaccessible to intuition, as you know. In Kant, understanding, intuition and reason are faculties on the basis of which true judgment is possible. These are faculties that digital writing profoundly transforms, either by delegating them to machines, as in the case with automated understanding, or by replacing them with machines, as is the case for the simulation of nanometric objects, or by purely and simply destroying reason as a faculty of synthesis, at the risk of unleashing an analytic understanding devoid of reason, but not of power. Rational synthesis is a process of individuating interpretation that cannot be reduced to calculation. Even though, like the poem, it necessarily involves calculation, that is, analysis. It is hermeneia that reason puts into play. And reason, beyond the analysis of the understanding, is the faculty of choosing between pharmacological possibilities, delineated from out of an infinite array of possible circumstances, and it is therefore a matter of going beyond analysis. Reason is that which judges in the strong sense of this term, that which decides by going beyond analysis, that is, it is that which interprets and which, as such, individuates itself noetically. This means that interpretation cannot be delegated to an analytic system of tertiary retentions. It, on the contrary, always consists in deciding between possibilities opened up by tertiary retentions, but that these tertiary retentions are not themselves capable of choosing between, however automated they may be. For here, to choose means precisely to disautomatize, that is, to create what Gilles Deleuze called a bifurcation. In Kant, the difference between analysis and synthesis grounds the difference between understanding and reason. I have argued that analytical understanding is made possible by tertiary retentions, insofar as they belong to a process of grammatization, such as the analysis of a written poem, an analysis made possible by writing, grammatization being the discretization, reproduction, and spatialization of temporal flows. But Synthesis too is made possible by analytic tertiary retentions. They affect the noetic psychic individual because, spatialized, they trace and make public potential conflicts of interpretation. Pharmacological conflicts between peers that affect these noetic individuals. And here I continue the analysis opened by my friend Gert Loving, quoting Chantal Mouffe. And these affects, the critical convergence of which is called reason, are what trigger interpretations. It is from this perspective that we should reread Spinoza. The process of transindividuation is what certifies the arbitration of these conflicts. Certification processes are themselves either analytic or synthetic. And in this case, they are elaborated on the basis of interpretations that result in categorical inventions. Hermeneia is in fact that which through glosses and commentaries of all kinds invents and generates new categories, whether analytic or synthetic, through which knowledge is transformed. New categories are certified when they are recognized by peers via analytic certifications that may on occasion be automated, but synthetic certifications which result in categorical inventions provoking bifurcations can never be delegated to systems, precisely because they are processes of interpretation. What does this mean for the design of MOOCs, books, POCs, e-books, social books, etc.? Circuits of rational transindividuation are anamnesic in the Socratic sense because they are ideally compatible with all certified circuits to which they are connected and of which they reactivate the originary meaning. And as we have seen, these certifications rest on categorization processes of all kinds, from Aristotle's table of categories to classifications, taxonomies, terminologies, descriptions, and specifications, and passing through disciplinary divisions, hierarchies, ontologies in all their forms, including those of today's automobile industry, as well as set theory in mathematics, the mathematical theory of categories based on the concept of functor, and so on. Knowledge is composed of terms and of rules of interpretation implementing these terms, which themselves constitute categories. The inscription of a new circuit of transindividuation extends an existing circuit, constituting a new categorical proposition founded on a bifurcation. And here, the word category must not be understood only in the Aristotelian and Kantian senses. Categories are not just Aristotle's ways of saying being, or Kant's pure concepts of understanding. Any original semantic production involves a possible categorical production, that is, transindividuation. The condition of an effective categorical production on the basis of a semantic production that makes it possible is the grammatization process that began in the Upper Paleolithic era as a spatial and discretized projection of temporal mental contents that thus become reproducible. This is a painting, a bas-relief, I don't remember in English, from Laurelief, from Chauvet in 31,000 years before us. And therefore, metastabilize a collective secondary retention projecting outside the man's, the mind, if not outside the psyche. As technologies of automated categorization that form the most recent stage of grammatization, digital retention profoundly transforms the cerebral and noetic activities of rational categorization. How does this delegation of the analytic faculties of understanding to digital retentional systems provide hope for a new age of reason, that is, a new capacity for interpretation, for hermeneia, and with it of idiomatic differentiation and individuation, given that all semantic categorical invention is an idiomatic differentiation supported by a psychic individuation? All knowledge as a set of collective secondary retentions remains incomplete and as such interpretable. And this is why it is always traversed by conflicts of interpretation about its future through which controversies take shape. What is shared analytically is not the subject of interpretation, whereas what is shared synthetically remains to be interpreted. And psychic singularities project themselves into these hermeneutic possibilities by inscribing in them their idiomatic differences. I refer here to the idiomaticity of those well-made languages that, according to Condillac, are the sciences. And I do so from a point of view that is obviously not Condillac's own view. These idiomatic differences produced by the hermeneutic activity of each scholar, insofar as he or she thinks for himself or herself, tend to become grouped into schools of thought on the basis of noetic affinities. We have seen that tertiary retentions, insofar as they enable the spatialization of noetic flows, condition the hermeneutic and heuristic exercise in which living knowledge always consists. A literal gloss or commentary is a fundamental dimension of the rational attentional form. With digital tertiary retentions, which are formal and automated systems of traceability, new attentional forms and new attentional peer communities are made possible by the making public of individual and collective interpretations and of the genesis of circuits of transindividuation that are formed. In the academic world, courses and seminars should become sites of the interpretation of teaching generating in the course of note-taking realized with relevant technologies, then the polemical editorialization of these notes, contributive processes of categorical invention. Peer communities would therefore form through controversies that function as genuine peer review systems, certified by teachers and by the practice through which students become genuine contributors to their teachers' research and are initiated into research, as should be the case for all university teaching. This conception ought to constitute the architectural principle for MOOCs designed from a rational point of view. These MOOCs thus form a new organological system of knowledge, that is, an ensemble of digital intellectual technology that lead to the publication of video books, which are also books supported by social networks of readers and controversies, that is, social books. All this demands a profound reconsideration of the characteristics of the web itself, The latter is, in the fact, now a system for calculating and eliminating all incomparable differences, that is, for erasing controversies and short-circuiting interpretations, as it was shown by the previous round table. MOOCs and all rational and academic practices of digital tertiary retention therefore introduce contributive, interpretative, and heuristic practices, and along with it, contributive certification processes. The Institute for Research and Innovation works in this way towards the design of platforms for note-taking, glosses, contributive indexing, and editorialization of digital audiovisual temporal flows, which through contributive categorization can be transformed into spatio-temporal objects, that is, into video books and social books. Tertiary retention requires the implementation of a new research policy and the organization of graduate schools that feed into the design of a noetic digital organology, constituting the field of so-called digital studies that I organized in IRI with a lot of universities in the world now. These graduate schools should become sites of digital publication supporting contributive categorization processes, that is, constituting contributive interpretative seminars that explicitly articulate the bottom-up with the top-down, drawing on transliteration technologies dedicated to the contributive categorization and publication of research, for example, in the form of video books and audiobooks of this type. More generally, this work should feed into a new conception of the web, founded on a graphic language of hermeneutic categorization of the data, emerging from this reticular writing. This is what the Institute for Research and Innovation is working on in cooperation with the University of Tokyo, the Federal Science Policy of Belgium, the French Ministry of Higher Education, the State of Ecuador, and the University of California, in order to build a digital republic encompassing Asia, America, Europe, and the rest of the world. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. So we're going to start with, I believe that Alessandro's group is to ask the first question.
Thank you very much. So we are the second half of the delegation. So thank you very much for your very nice theoretical presentation. My question is about the relationships between, I would say, the old industrial model and the new episteme, because you talk a lot about the new episteme related to the digital tertiary mode of retention, and about in your last slides about the new ways of teaching. But also you relate to a new industrial model in your abstract. But we are interested by the relationship between the old one, especially the tension and negotiation. So how are this existing old industrial model and the new emerging one are related today?
Okay, thank you for this question. Important question, very important for me. What is a new industrial model? It is a model where it's not a sequential organization of division of labor which works, but precisely a participatory or contributive organization of work, which can become a new hyper-proletarianized organization of work, as it was shown by our colleague of New School, but which can also invent a new process which is based on what I call a process of deproletarianization, which works in some groups of free software organizations, for example. Personally, I decided to work on this question because I was a manager of INA in France, which is a company of 1,000 people, and where I had 70 engineers developing in free software, and I discovered this new organization, which is an industrial organization of work based on the increasing of capacities in this, or capabilities in the sense of Amartya Sen. And for me, the development of capabilities is a process of deproletarianization. The question of proletarianization is a question of political economy, but it is also a question of philosophy and metaphysics. The first thinker of proletarianization is Plato, when he says, by using writing, you exteriorize your knowledge and you lose your knowledge. You can destroy your knowledge. He's right. You can destroy your knowledge. If you don't re-interiorize it, you will become a proletarian, you know. And I believe that this is what is at stake in the works by Marx, particularly in the Communist Manifesto. It's the beginning, but mainly in the Grundrisse, the grounds of the critique of political economy, where Marx shows that machines of the industrial revolution are, in fact, processes of exteriorization of knowledge, and this exteriorization allows the spoliation, the captation of knowledge by the capital, and the transformation of knowledge into capital, and the transformation of the psychic individuals into human resources, that is, manpower. So, I believe that we will develop not only industrial, but what I call a hyper-industrial society in the next years, in the next decades. I don't believe in post-industrial societies. I believe that this is a fable. The fable of post-modernity and Alain Touraine, who is a sociologist who was preparing the catastrophe of the French left with this concept of post-industrial society. There is no post-industrial society, no future for a post-industrial society. The future is industrial and hyper-industrial, but this hyper-industrialization should be based on a new organization of research, scientific research, academic activities, etc. Because the beginning of industrial revolution was the beginning of a new relationship between knowledge and economy through technology. So, if we want to create, let's say, a participatory society which is really producing a, let's say, if you agree, a good participation, a fruitful participation, participation for producing collective individuation and not collective disindividuation, we must completely transform the universities, the academic sphere in the totality, and which we must begin by the doctoral school, by the PhD seminars, etc. Because it must begin by research. In this level of the industrial society that research is, we must develop what I call a contributive research, in which the contributive research is practicing action research by using contributive technologies for producing categorization, because knowledge is based on categorization, not only formal knowledge. To produce, for example, a shoe needs categorization, you know, categorization of the knowledge of the matter, etc., etc. A tool is producing a categorization. A hammer produces a type of a category for treating the matter, etc., etc. So categorization is not simply a concept for the formal knowledges. It is the transformation of the real by all the ways, mathematics, etc. Mathematics or or agriculture, or everything you need, you want. Now, the relationship to the transformation of the new model, new industrial model, and my topic today is extremely close, because an industrial model is a transformation of society produced by new types of formalization, new categorization, etc. So it is extremely linked. So it's not possible, for example, to struggle for inventing new social organization by social innovation, for example, without making a link with PhD seminars, with doctoral researchers, etc. I don't say that universities should lead these experiences, these initiatives, not at all. But I say that we must organize a link between social innovation and academic innovation, which is not an innovation in technologies, but which is an innovation in the organization of knowledge, that is production of new axioms, new theorems, etc.
So, do we have another question?
To follow up on this, what are the forces in society today that could produce this sort of transformation of higher education, these at doctorate level, these new forms of research that will create these new categories? If you say that universities will not be able to produce it themselves, where will it come from?
They are everywhere. But I believe in rationality. And I believe that, I don't believe that human is rational, but I believe in rationality. So I believe that the current organization of the web, for example, is anthropic. It is destroying itself. The Snowden shock is only the symptom of a much more important problem, much more important, which is that the web doesn't work like the inventors of the web wanted to make it working, you know. And it doesn't work because the recommendations produced in the W3C by the GAFA particularly, but not only them, by the market, imposed a new organization of the web. So, and this is not rational because it is destroying. My friend Frédéric Kaplan has shown that, for example, Google has completely transformed with his automatic translator, with his search engine, the evolution of languages. This is the reason for which I spoke about idiomatic differences. There is an acceleration of the destruction of idiomatic differences with this process of automatic translation, for example, which is extremely efficient, which concerns the whole languages in the world, even the small languages, for example, for Amazonia, etc. And this process is producing an anthropic destruction of knowledge. And it is a problem for Google, because Google needs to have idiomatic differences. So it is a paradox. It is a contradiction. These contradictions are expressed in the life, in society everywhere, with a lot of different types of symptoms and counter-organization, which are produced in the margins, in the underground, but not only in this, you know. So, I believe, for example, the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, a Wall Street movement in the 2010 or 12 or 11 was a movement expressing these contradictions. But they didn't have the concepts for really developing a perspectives or development of propositions of new axioms, etc., etc. So it became, at the end, a kind of impasse. But I believe that it was the first stage, and now we have the second one is the Snowden moment. I call this the blues of the net, in which the community of activists discover that the web is a pharmacon, is extremely toxic. And the question is not to say the web will change a society. No, the web will never change a society. It's only the society which can change a society. But if the society has not a clear understanding of the pharmacological dimension of the web, it will never change in the good way. So I believe that there are potentials everywhere in the world, but we lack the grid of concepts for creating links between those different possibilities. But now, with this crisis of let's say the digital model, maybe we will become a little bit more rational with these questions.
Yeah, trying to follow up on this question. One could argue that your call for a new organization of knowledge or production of knowledge could, as a matter of fact, come right out of Silicon Valley, could come out of the research that these companies are doing, and thus then provide a reorganization of the way that we are linked, that we communicate, that we produce knowledge. In what way would you see a qualitative difference in what you're proposing?
Yeah. This is the question, the most important question. I believe in commons for this, let's say, noetic economy. When I use economy here, I use the word economy practiced by Georges Bataille when he speaks of what he calls general economy, which is an economy which is not only the economy of market, of money, of transaction, but what he described as what I call personally a libidinal economy. That is an economy of sublimation, an economy of idealization, an economy of, let's say, libido sciendi. And I believe that it's not possible to reduce the libido sciendi to the economy of market. It's impossible. If you do that, you destroy libido sciendi. And if you destroy libido sciendi, you destroy the market itself, because the industrial society needs a libido sciendi. So there is a contradiction in this, which is the contradiction of the destruction of the distinction between osium and negotium, which was at the basis of the Western society, not only the Western one, Asiatic society too, in another sense with the Zen culture. Now, personally, I believe that the success story of the Western society begins in 1088. With the creation of University of Bologna by the Pope. The Pope created 1,000 years ago the first university, which was at the beginning a faculty of theology. But in 1165, he had a conflict with Frederick Barbarus, the imperator of the Christianic Europe. And in this conflict, the imperator of Barbarus decided to give a pure, absolute autonomy to Bologna. And it was the beginning of the success story of the West by the creation of the Sorbonne, Cambridge, Oxford, firstly, Cambridge, etc., the Sorbonne, and Harvard later. And it became a very strong civilization because it had, this civilization had the concepts and the means for these concepts to dominate the whole world. Now, this was based on a complete autonomy given to the universities. And nobody tried to change this but the conservatory revolution. The conservative revolution. Which said, now the universities must become the market. And this is absolutely crazy. Because what is the problem of market? The market is only working by computation, by calculation. And what is produced as knowledge is uncalculable. This is what is at stake in knowledge. All kind of knowledge. Paintings, geometry, philosophy, physics, etc. What is interesting for a thinker of such knowledge is not the computation, the existing and computable reality. It is the concept producing an ideality like the geometrical point or the theory of generalized relativity, etc., which is an idealization. And this is only this process of idealization which is producing what we call, since Schrödinger, negentropy. So, negentropy in societies, in social organizations. So I believe that it is not possible to continue to make these organizations of university working, functioning, and it will change, necessarily. Maybe because some people will become rational and more clever, or maybe because there will have a catastrophe, and after this catastrophe, we will re-begin with a new organization. Because sometimes, as we know with John Diamond, sometimes we need to pass by such a catastrophe. But I believe it is possible to create a global community of academic people, not only academic. When I say academic, for me, it's not the university only. It is also in the sense of Immanuel Kant saying that in the last book, The Conflict of Faculties, Immanuel Kant says, we have the academic people, he calls them cooperative professors. But we have also, he says, the academies, les sociétés savantes of Republic of Letters. They are not at all coming from the academic sphere, but they are the new scholars. They are inventing the modern science, etc. And today there is a process like that, which is extremely complicated to analyze because it is always double-sided. It is a Janus process. On the one side, you have the hyper-proletarianization with the contributive organization of work and the networks. But on the other side, you have really new societies created by the net, on which you have really new inventions, new organizations, etc. And innovation comes from there now. That's clear. So, it is a very difficult question, but I believe that there is a kind of rationality which is for us.
So I think we have time for a last question.
So perhaps this will be more a point of clarification, but I had a question about the transition from primary to secondary retentions. And in particular, I'm wondering if different value systems or ideological commitments differentiate the way apodictic experience becomes a memory. So in other words, are most forms of psychic individuations similar within an epoch, or can an individual's attention have a significant impact on the way the primary retention becomes secondary?
Could you repeat it slowly, please? Excuse me, because you
spoke
a little bit too fast for me. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So Are most forms of psychic individuation similar within an epoch, or can an individual's attention have a significant impact on the way the primary retention becomes secondary?
First, your primary attention always becomes secondary. The problem is not the transformation of primary attention into secondary attentions. This is a kind of automatic process. The problem is how to produce with secondary retentions, psychic secondary retentions, collective secondary retentions. This is a question. You agree with me?
Yes.
So the question is, for example, I said before there are, I don't know, 80 persons in this room, and they make 80 different interpretation or understanding of what I say. And even my own interpretation is different. The question is, how shall we produce not the same, but a convergence in which maybe we will discover that there are the materialist and the idealist, for example, people, you know, the rationalist and the spiritualist. I use stupid categories, but you understand what I mean. Why are they here, materialist people? Because there are materialist collective secondary retentions which circulate in the world for 2 centuries, maybe. And some of us, myself, for example, I am a kind of materialist. It's complicated because I am also a reader of Bergson, I am also a reader of a lot of people which are not materialists. So I try to produce something new, which is based on the concept of what I call hypermatter, which is not opposed to spirit, but it is another question. Now, here in this room, there are people sharing, there are main groups sharing collective tertiary, secondary and tertiary retentions, you know, reading the same books, not exactly the same, but using the same networks, the same groups, etc. And naturally, they tend to think not exactly the same thing, but comparable things. You know. Why suddenly somebody will arrive and transform a group? Because you have a group, let's say, for example, people who are materialists, guys and people, and suddenly somebody says we should change materialism, we should produce, this is what I said just before, hypermaterialism, hypermatter, the concept of hypermatter. The concept of hypermatter is a concept which doesn't oppose form and matter. And the first thinker of this is Gilbert Simondon, who was not only a philosopher, but a very, very good specialist of quantum mechanics. And in this theory of quantum mechanics, you can't separate matter and form. It doesn't work. Matter and form are not at all relevant. What is relevant is energy and information. So you can't. Stay in this concept of matter, and you must change it. So, when suddenly somebody is capable to change, to create what I call a collective individuation, which is suddenly producing a new organization of the collective tertiary and secondary retentions and pretensions, because in the retentions you have pretensions. In your retentions, in your mind, in your memory, you keep pretensions. Some of them are purely automatic. This is what was discovered by David Hume with the process of association. And when he said causality is produced by process of association of traces of experience. And other are not at all automatic. They are purely singular. They are linked to your psyche, your unconscious, your id, etc., etc. That is what I call traumatic. And this traumaticity of your memory is produced by what I call the default that is produced by Epimetheus' fault. That is the fact that we are incomplete. This is the base of what is called by Jacques Lacan lack of desire, which is not at all a lack for me. I believe that. I agree with Deleuze for that. This is not a lack. It is a default, what I call a default. And this default is always the possibility of a new interpretation. If your default, you are capable to transform your default in a process of interpretation, which is capable of producing a contamination of the other secondary pretension and retention of your group, you can produce a process of identification to your traumatic interpretation, and you can produce something which is exactly what is happening with Socrates. Because Socrates is producing exactly this, a trauma, which is his own trauma, and creating suddenly something which is called philosophy, which is the origin of universities, that is of the West. So he was the guy who suddenly produced a type of individuation like this one. So I answer your question too shortly because it is a very complicated question. But I could say that for beginning to answer your question.
Thank you very much.
Merci.
So just before you all leave, I just want to make one or two thank yous and to sort of bring this to a closure. So a special thanks to all the participating speakers, to the audience, to the colloquium organizing team, which is of course, Tamar Tembeck, a wonderful job, and yes, you can do that. With Sophie Tupin and Mary Chin, the team of the Musée d'Art Contemporain Montréal, and in particular François Letourneux, to our hardworking French interpreters who are just working there from the back. The PCOND research delegates and their team members, to our PUC facilitator, Alexandre Milsoff, to our web administrators, Kathleen Loney and Justin Barrow-Burns, to our social media consultant, Mauricio Delphin, our designer, Connor Prendergast, and to everyone else who made this colloquium a success. I just want to mention one point, is that the videos of the colloquium will be archived online at pcond.ca and media.mcgill.ca. And finally, that the participatory open online course, which is a POOC, is still running until December 6th, and it will also remain fully archived online at pcond.ca. So thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.